with great pleasure that I introduce to you a man who has three children that is sterile, Tom Bailey.
I have four children, and I'm still sterile. Tom Brown's my name, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I want to thank everyone for making this afternoon possible, inviting Betty and I to your great conference to share. It's truly a privilege, and I am just overwhelmed with the friendship and the love that's already been shown me while just arriving yesterday. I've made some great friends, one-on-one AA talks with a lot of you, and I hope I can continue to do that after this afternoon. I couldn't help but think for a minute that when Pete was asking for volunteers for the entertainment tonight, that I'm surprised that there aren't more participants. And I'll bet you if I gave everybody a fifth, you'd have some bizarre entertainment, I guarantee it. I wouldn't recommend it, however. I heard two talks last night, and the Alateen was just superb. I don't hear many Alateen talks, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. And, of course, I heard my wife, Betty. I've heard her before. That's a miraculous, believe me, it's a remarkable thing that happened. I can remember 20 years ago that I couldn't sit for a minute and listen to her talk. And then to come into Alcoholics Anonymous and start to get well and sit down there for an hour or whatever and thoroughly enjoy it and learn. I learned from her talking, as I try to do with every talk, but I truly love it, and it's just like being in a movie. I don't remember that honeymoon that she talked about, and I'm hoping at every time I hear her speak that she'll fill me in on some of the other great things that happened. It was a catastrophe, as Betty said, but we've come a long way since that, and I want to tell you here and now that without Betty, I just wouldn't want to make it, truthfully. She put me into Alcoholics Anonymous. She saved my life. And she mentioned in her talk that we have our ups and downs. We're human beings. We have our good days and we have our bad days. But we know how to compete with the disagreements or arguments that we have. We have learned the capacity to be able to go to one another and say you're sorry, and I love you. Let's knock this off. It's just not important. Life is too damn short. I don't know where the last 18 years went, but it went awful fast. My kids are grown. They're young ladies, young, beautiful young ladies. And the time is so essential to me. And I'll be darned if I'm going to go through the rest of the time that I have left arguing and bickering about things that don't make any difference anyway. And Betty works the same philosophy on me, working our programs together, and I truly mean it when I say it gets better every day. We're making great strides. I think she's a super gal. I know one thing that always helps me keep my mouth shut, and I always mention this because I think it's important. I've had a big mouth, and I've been right all of my drunken years. I was never wrong. And one of the things that helps me keep it shut and to be able to go to her and say, I'm sorry, let's forget it. I often think if the shoe was on the other foot, and if she and I could have exchanged places 18 years ago, I just wonder how how much of a job it would have been for me. I wonder if I could have had the capacity to be able to forgive and forget some of the things that I dragged her through. And there isn't any question in my mind, I know without exception that I couldn't have cut it. I wouldn't have lived with her 5 minutes. And this helps me, believe me, to say, babe, I'm sorry. I truly am sorry. Words that I never ever spoke as a drunkard. I always like to mention that my dry day is April the 21st, 1963. I've enjoyed a little over 18 years of uninterrupted sobriety, and I don't say that to impress anybody here in the room. My days of trying to impress people are over, believe me. But I'll have to admit that it impresses me. Very much so. When I was given the choice of either joining Alcoholics Anonymous or Betty was going to take the children and leave, and I was beat, didn't know it, but I was beat. Booze had finally whipped me, and I made that phone call to the central office. It's the most valuable phone call I'll ever make in my life. And I went to the phone, I'll never forget it, as though it was yesterday, and I dialed the number with Betty standing right at my shoulder, and Dick P. answered the phone. Dick is of Mexican descent, and I didn't know whether I'd the Mexican government on the phone, or I thought I'd dialed the wrong number, and anything that he said didn't make sense, and I'm sure that he felt the way. But I always look at that as the most valuable, most important phone call I'll ever make, and I truly mean that. It saved my life. And I always give Betty the credit for putting me into Alcoholics Anonymous. Long before I took my first drink, I had problems. I didn't know it then, but I know it today. I know that I had a lot of ego problems. Most of you know that I've been privileged to participate in sports throughout my younger life. And I couldn't handle the applause or the acclaim and some of the awards that were bestowed upon me. And I became, as I really believe, the greatest thing that ever walked. And then when I took my first drink, it stimulated all of these character defects. It made it almost impossible to live with me. I was impossible to live with. And it almost killed me. And I always say today that if booze hadn't eventually done or taken its toll, I'm sure it would have. But if I should have been spared, the ego would have killed me. It was terrible. And I have to guard and watch and guard against it today. Thank God I'm aware of what ego can do to a person. My sponsor tells me it's very important to qualify. I'm sure after listening to Betty last night that you know I belong here. I kid her a lot about taking my inventory. But she does it in such a way that it's not really offensive. But take my word for it, I belong here. And I don't intend to qualify a great degree today. The big book tells us to tell what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I'll try to do that. And my first drink in high school, I never truly liked the taste of liquor or beer or anything. But I liked what it did to me. I told my dad that I'd been sober a couple of years, and he and my mother were visiting Betty and I. And at the kitchen table, I just mentioned it. I said, you know, Dad, I really and truly never liked the taste of it. And he looked at me right in the eye and he says, I thank God for that. But I did like what it did to me. It made me better. It made me bigger. It made me do things to a better degree, I thought. And I drank to excess from the word go. I don't ever remember just taking a couple of drinks. I always drank more than my share and never wanted to go home, always winding up the party. or whatever. And I did this through high school and into college. I keep mentioning my background as far as football, and I don't want anybody to think that I'm living and trying to exploit the things that happened to me. It's part of my story, and I know that I'm a damn lucky guy to have been given the opportunity to play in the National Football League, as well as in any other sport with my friends and young athletes. I know where I'm going today, and I know who I am and what I am. But I was privileged to have a scholarship to several schools, mostly in the South, and I chose the College of William & Mary. And much to my surprise, after I had told them that I would attend, and I went down for the exam, entrance exam and so forth, I wasn't accepted. My grades were too low. I was a failure in most everything that I did when booze entered my life. You know, we hear success stories in Alcoholics Anonymous and in Al-Anon and Al-Ateen. Heard two last night. Real true success stories. And I had a success story. But when I was drinking, everything was downhill. I did that by myself. I didn't have any help. I became a failure all by myself. And the moment that I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had help. I had help and I didn't want help. I had help and I didn't think that I needed help. God, did I get the help? And when I asked for it, man, the whole world caved in on me. Everybody wanted to help me. So you become a success with the help of others and the help of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the way it was with me. I had to go to a military academy to become eligible to play football for the College of William & Mary. And I attended the Fort Union Military Academy and never stopped drinking. Just had, I thought I was on a, just an extended vacation. My grades did come up a little bit and I went to college and never changed my pattern of drinking. Never intended to. Didn't think I had a problem. Anytime I got into a jam, I had coaches. I had some of the people on the staff that got me out of this problem. The same as it has been all my life up until then. People forever helping me. I didn't think I had a problem. I was unlucky, and some people had it in for me, especially those damn cops. And one thing and another, but I didn't really ever think that it was the booze that was doing it. And I had two years at William & Mary, very successful as an athlete, but a lousy student. I did not apply myself. Nobody could make this alcoholic do anything that he didn't want to do, and I just refused to study. Well, naturally, I was a failure, and I got into a lot of trouble. War broke out, of course, in 1942, and I took the easy way out. I knew my parents were not aware. I didn't think they were aware of my failing, but I thought this would save face, and I called and told them that I had enlisted, and they would never know that I had flunked out of college. I know today that my mother and father knew long before I did that I was a failure. It wasn't any real secret, but I kept trying to cover up, kidding myself. I went enlisted into the Air Corps and went home to wait to be called into service. And then this opportunity came up. There were several months that I had to wait. And I guess if there was any one man in the world that I would have listened to at this particular time in my life, it was my high school coach, who I had become very fond of. And Reed stopped me uptown in Butler, Pennsylvania. And he says, why don't you go up and try out with the Steelers? Well, this was a lifelong dream that I had had. But I thought, being a failure in college, only 2 years, it would be impossible. And Reed says, anything's impossible. Go on up and give it a shot. He says, I think you can do it. To make a long story short, and I won't get into detail, I just did that. I went up and was privileged enough to cut it, and I made the team and played a lot of beautiful football and really enjoyed every second of it in that 1942 season. football, I don't know, it was a release for me. I used to love to smack guys. Jesus, I loved to hit. And I think that this got it out of my system. I really mean that. Looking back on those years, I got a lot out of doing that. I always felt better for it. And I loved it. These guys today, and I have a lot of respect and admiration for the athlete of today. But quibbling about the money and the benefits turned me off completely. I played just for damn near for nothing, to be honest with you. And I would, I think, today, because I loved it so much. In any event, I was a failure at that also. That year, I was fined 3 times for drunkenness. I'll just tell you one incident that happened. After one of the games at Forbes Field, the Pittsburgh Steelers had 3 station wagons. And on the side of the station wagons, they had Pittsburgh Steelers Football Club. This drew attention. It was impressive. And by God, I had to have one of those wagons. And so I always say I borrowed it, but I really stole it damn thing. That's what I did. Took it without permission, and I start making the rounds in East Liberty. I could get in any of the clubs. Pittsburgh has a lot of them. And we start making the rounds, and I had a car, a wagon full of friends. And in the wee hours of the morning, I hit a man on Liberty Avenue crossing the street, knocked him down. My reflexes in those years were fairly decent, and I swerved and didn't hit him full head on, thank God. But he was shook up, and so was I and my friends, and we got out of the wagon and picked him up and had him along the side of the fender there, and we were talking, and I asked him, his leg was cut, and I said, well, go to a hospital, I'll take you to the hospital, I'll pay for everything, don't worry, I didn't want any trouble. And he was all right, he didn't want to go, he was middle-aged. And finally, he spotted the sign on the side of the wagon. And then he looked at me and he says, you know, he says, I was at the game today. And he says, I know you. You played. He says, I saw you playing. And we talked a few minutes. And, hell, we were getting along wonderful. In fact, I thought he was glad I hit him. And after a while, a policeman come around the corner. And he sized up the situation and put me through one of those walk the line tests, and Jesus, I flunked it. And I spent that night in the Pittsburgh jail. Mr. Rooney got me out the next morning, and they kept it quiet. But that was a serious offense. It could have been a fatal accident. I didn't learn from that. I kept drinking and getting into trouble. As I say, I was fined 3 times in 1942. I went into the service after that season as an aviation cadet, and I love to fly. I've talked to a few pilots in the audience today, and flying next to football was the most important thing in my life, and I really and truly learned to love it. Aviation cadet training consisted of ground school work, that's back into college again, which I hated, and then you flew with your ability and the things that they had taught you with MiG training. And I had good grades flying. I was a good flyer. I had A grades. My ground school work was suffering miserably. I was failing. They average these 2 grades together, and this is the passing grade. And I was just cutting. I was just making it. In any event, I went through basic, advanced, into advanced, and I was flying AT-6s with just a couple of weeks to graduate. I was getting wings from my parents and bars. And I was going to be commissioned. And everything was beautiful, and the world was just great, I thought. And I celebrated one evening, and I went into town and got drunk, slated to fly on a cross country the following morning. And I took off as scheduled. I was still drunk, and I flew that airplane in the exact opposite manner in which I had been taught. I was cocky and sure of myself, sure of the maneuvers that I had to make, and the treetop level with not sufficient airspeed, I broke out of my takeoff pattern and proceeded to buzz the trees. And I was called on the radio and told to report back to the base. They didn't know what kind of a character had slipped into that airplane, but they wanted him back. And real cocky and sure of myself, I landed and reported to the tower, absolutely certain that I could talk my way out of it. I'd had a couple of previous infractions and had won. I had won that deal, so there was no problem. All my life I was getting out of deals, getting out of trouble, people helping me. And this shouldn't be any different. Much to my surprise, they quarantined me to my barracks and base. I wasn't allowed off the base. And 4 or 5 days later, I was washed out of the class of 43K in front of a whole corps of cadets. One of the most humiliating experiences I ever had. And from that time on, I became real tough to handle. I wouldn't do anything. And I found out that when you're in the service, you do or else, you know. And I spent some times in the guardhouse and jails from that time on all over the country. And I never found one that I was comfortable in. They're all jails, regardless how you look at it. And my orders were cut, and I was supposed to report to Denver, Colorado, Lowry Field number 2. I won't go into much detail on this except to say that I never had an order cut on me. I'd never been on my own away from cadet training. And I went into town, naturally, to get drunk. And I was sitting at the bar, and there was a staff sergeant sitting next to me. And I was crying the blues to him and telling him my problems. And he says, "Let me see your orders." And I showed him, and he says, "My God," he said, after he had read them, he says, "You got a good deal here." He says, "You could take the rest of the year to go to Denver." And I says, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, your orders read, report on arrival to Denver, Colorado, Lowry Field number 2. He says, "Hell, there's no time of arrival on it." I had him explain that to me a couple other times. And when I tell you it took me the better part of a month to go from Valdosta to Denver, believe it. I'd get off the train and I'd get drunk and I'd get in trouble. My MPs would put me back on the train and I'd call home for more money. It was just one wild month. And I got up to Denver and I refused to go to the school that I had been designated to attend. And naturally, they put me in the guardhouse. The CO of the 775th got me out after reading my record. And he said that you used to, he says, "I see you used to play football." I was out of it again. He liked athletes. I got out of that jam. He put me in charge of a basketball team, and that's all I did.
Virginia Nestle, an emergency on the phone. Virginia Nestle, I'm sorry. All right.
Virginia here?
Nestle,
N-U-S-S-L-E. In any event, I refused to go to that school, and my CO got me out, and he bailed me out of that trouble. And I was put in charge of a basketball team, and you know, I couldn't even handle that opportunity. I just didn't have the capacity to keep it straight. And I don't think I saw my basketball team play more than 6 or 7 games that year. I was in Denver getting drunk. I got into a lot of trouble, and finally, after that basketball season, I was sent to the 4th Air Force to participate in the 283 program, more or less playing football for the 4th Air Force. And I was made a staff sergeant. They made us all staff sergeants, those who weren't commissioned. And I had it made. All I had to do was keep my nose clean. And I got drunk and got in trouble. And at the end of that year, Major Paul Schisler just about had it with me, and the team was broken up and we were sent to different parts of the country. And I want to tell you about this because I never mentioned it, but my wife, a few years ago, we were talking about some of these things, and she says that, and I usually listen to what Betty tells me, she says that she thought it would be important to put into my talk, so I have. I ended up from the 4th Air Force sent down to Cuba, Batista Airfield, and they did this more or less to keep us out of the infantry, to be honest with you. And down in Cuba, it was just a paradise. It was a beautiful island. The girls were just gorgeous, and the rum was excellent, and things were just super. I loved it, and I was having a ball. I didn't have any duties to perform, just get drunk and have fun. Boy, I truly love Cuba. And one weekend, the base was quarantined. We weren't allowed off the base. So I went to the PX and I got my supply of booze, and I thought that quarantine evidently was for everybody but me. And I took a Jeep and I talked my way through the gate and I went into town, and I had the whole town, I figured, to myself. And boy, I started to live it up. Needless to say, I was captured. Brought back to Batista and thrown in the guardhouse. I resisted arrest. The things that I'd done were never made perfectly clear to me, but I was beat up quite badly, and I was given several months of hard labor in that dungeon, as I called it. And I'll tell you a little bit about that. I said that I had some harrowing experiences. This was the worst I ever experienced in my life. One week they would have me out picking up pieces of paper all over the base, and my friends would ride by in jeeps and trucks, and I couldn't even acknowledge their hellos. I was too ashamed. It was most humiliating. The next week I would be in the sugar canes cutting sugar cane in 110 degrees in the shade with all those damn spiders falling on me, and I hate spiders, and I was so disgusted and despondent with life, I didn't care what happened to me. I'd had it. I didn't care to live, really. And we were all assigned guards. We referred to them as gooks. They were Puerto Rican soldiers. The one that was guarding me, I couldn't understand him. He would gibber and jabber in his foreign tongue, and I hope and pray to God he never understood me either, but I used to let him know exactly how I felt. But every time I would slow up or stop, he would put that M1 right in the middle of my back, and hard, I mean hard, and give me that good, and he says, move on, you know. And I developed such a dislike for him. I truly hated him, and I'm sure he felt the same way about me. And one night after one of these experiences in the sugar field, I made up my mind, if he ever did it again, I was going to take that rifle away from him and beat him over the head with it. And I really and truly thought about it. I really wanted to do it. And a few days later, the opportunity came, and I whirled on this guy, and I started after him, and he, quick as a cat, he was backed up, and he had that thing cocked. And I know that if I hadn't stopped, he'd have put a hole in me as big as a baseball. That night I laid in my bunk, and I just, all hope had elapsed. I never thought that I'd ever get out of that place alive, because I didn't care. And a few weeks following that, the football team was coming back to L.A., and for some unknown reason that I don't know today why or who or what happened, I got out, they let me out, and I joined the team and went back to the 4th Air Force. And you know, I said to myself, I'll never, ever, ever get myself into a situation like that again. Words that I had uttered hundreds of times in my drunken 26 years of fooling around with the booze. But boy, I meant it this time, as I did on every occasion. And I went back, and for a few weeks, things were great. And we were at a party one night, and I had a few bucks in my pocket, and the guys were all having a great time, and I was kind of like a fifth wheel. So I figured, what the hell, I'll watch myself. I want to tell you, it was just a matter of a couple of hours, and I was just as bad off as I'd ever been in my life as far as the drink was concerned. I was the last one to leave. I drank more than anybody else, I guess, and I got into trouble. So I hadn't learned one single thing. And from that day on, I just kept drinking. I was honorably discharged and went back with Pittsburgh, 1946. In the third game of the season, I got caught drinking. I was sent down to the farm club in Richmond, and I won't delve into that in any great detail. I was constantly in trouble with no respect for my coaches. The next year, they sent me to Portsmouth at another farm club. And then in 1948, the Brooklyn Dodgers gave me a contract, and without any hesitation, I signed it and sent it back. My college coach was in charge of the Brooklyn Dodgers at 48 under Branch Rickey, and I went up there and made the team, played in 5 league games with the Brooklyn Dodgers, and really loved it, loved every second of it. And then I got drunk, and I fought with my teammate and roommate, tore down a motel, just ruined it. They didn't have a farm club. Brooklyn was a newly organized team, and they gave me my outright release in 1948. And I was too ashamed and humiliated to go back to Butler. I ended up in Erie, Pennsylvania with the Erie Vets, and that was the last year that I played football. I ran from coast to coast for the next half a dozen years, back and forth, always coming back home like the whipped dog with his tail between his legs in my dad's house. And I did this, I just always running away from responsibility. I couldn't assume anything at all. I'll never forget waking up on the living room floor of my father's home, and he was looking down at me, and he had his foot in my ribs. He says, "I want you to get up off of that floor. I want you to get the few things that you have in this house together and get out." He says, "I never want you to come back." Well, what was he doing to me? I hated him. That quick, I hated my dad. And I got up, and it caused a great argument between my mother and my father, as it had for a number of years. Mothers always come to your defense, I found out, and they're all the same. Wherever you go, they're the same. And it caused a great rift between the two of them, but I had to get out, and my dad knew what he was doing. I didn't quit drinking, but I went into Pittsburgh, and I had to get a job, and I had to get a place to live. I had to start making my own way. He was through. He wasn't going to give me another dime. So I got a job, and I made good money. Worked on the south side in Pittsburgh with the Malone Company, and was a pretty good outside salesman, plumbing supplies, and made a good wage. If I would have been making $100,000 in those years, it wouldn't have been enough, because I was a big shot, and I liked to spend money, and I liked to be a big deal wherever I went. When I drank, everybody drank, and things of that nature, and I borrowed off everybody I came face to face with. Needless to say, my creditors caught up with me and the finance companies, and the pressure was on, so I did the only thing that I knew how to do. What the hell, I'll just get out of this area and start over. So I went to Cleveland. And this is when I met my wife, Betty. I always say that God placed Betty right in my path. It was a godsend to me, and I don't know whether Betty wants to go to that extent or not, but it saved my life. I know that today. But shortly after arriving in Cleveland, the creditors and my finance companies knew where I was, and I was back in trouble. My new employer, bailed me out of this, paid off those loans, and took so much out of my wage. And this was great. I was still getting out of jams. People were always helping me. Betty and I had a whirlwind courtship, and she told you about the honeymoon. And I did sense some responsibility with my new family, and I became a periodic for a while. And then on Friday night, I started drinking on Thursday night, on Wednesday night, and on Tuesday night after one. I was right back as a daily drinker before you knew it. It happened so quickly, and we were in constant problems. We had constant problems, as Betty pointed out. Fights all the time. I changed jobs. The grass always looked greener to me on the other side of the street, so I took a similar job on the other end of town. And shortly after I was there, we had a sales meeting. And this was my second to last drunk. Betty mentioned my last one. I hope to pray to God it was my last one. But my second to last drunk went something like this. I started to tell my new employer how to run his business. I didn't agree with things that he was doing. And I was pushing people around. I broke a piece of furniture. The last thing I can remember at that meeting that night was sitting down at the dinner table, and I had another complete blackout. I woke up in the Rocky River Jail. My nose was out of place, and I had blood all over my clothes. And I was sick. Oh, God, I was so sick. And I had no idea what had happened the night before. This was frightening. The fears in my drunken years were just more than I could endure. I never had any fears before I started drinking. And shortly after I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, the fears set in. I was fearful of everything. I haven't got any fears today. Thank God for that. Sobriety took care of it. And boy, I'll be forever grateful for that, if nothing else. But that morning in jail, I was scared. And I knew that I had done something that was pretty bad, or I wouldn't be in the position I was in. They wouldn't let me make a phone call. I had already talked to Betty the night before. She didn't have $250. She didn't know where she could get it, and I'm not so sure she would have if she had. But a friend of mine came down and got me out of that jail. I went across the street and I had a couple of beers to settle down. And Vic said, go on home. He said, things will shape up. Well, he didn't know Betty. And I went home, and we had one of our worst fights ever. And I can remember getting on my knees and begging and crying like a little kid to please, just one more chance. And after a little argument and pleading, Betty must have had a little bit of compassion left, and she says, one more chance. And I scrounged around for a job. I couldn't get one. Nobody would hire me. It was around Christmas time. My parents helped us out, as they'd always done. And then the opportunity presented itself to me, the one that I'm still enjoying. I had to go to Indiana to get this interview for a sales representative job in Northern Ohio. I went over to Indiana and met Mr. Young, and for some unknown reason, he hired me. And he owned a nightclub on the other end of the lake that he also owned. And he said, meet me over at the Pirate's Roost. And he says, we'll have a couple of drinks and secure this new understanding and agreement. I says, that's a great idea, Steve. And I went over to the Pirate's Roost, and I had a half a dozen drinks. Steve joined me, and we had a few more. And Steve, we shook hands, and he went on about his business, went home. And I stayed there for two more days. I was arrested 50 miles from Flora, Indiana, where the plant is located. And the state patrol pulled me over, and I started telling him who I was, and he didn't care. And then I said the magic word. I mentioned Steve Young, Stephen A. Young Corporation. And Steve knew all of those patrolmen. And they said, you work for him? I says, I do. And they called him up. In a half an hour, I'm back in my car with my booze on the way back to Cleveland. I was coming from the west, of course. I missed Cleveland completely. I ended up in Chagrin Falls at some friends' homes, and that's when I made that phone call to Betty. Anytime I wanted another 2 days out, all I had to do was call Betty, and we'd get into a violent argument over the phone. She could smell me over the telephone. This didn't happen this day. I called her, and she answered the phone very calmly, and she said that she and the children had been worried about me, but was glad that I was safe and sound back in town, and not to hurry to come home, because by the time you arrive, she says, the children and I will be gone, and she hung up. I thought I had the wrong number, truthfully. But I knew that there was something amiss, and I got into my car, and I got home just in time. Betty was packed, and the suitcases, and the kids were all dressed, and we had one violent argument. The cab pulled in the driveway, and I wouldn't let that turkey in, and I wouldn't let Betty out. And it was just a real turmoil, believe me. And finally, after a lot of argument, Betty turned to me and she says, you either call Alcoholics Anonymous, or when you pass out or fall asleep, I'm going to leave with the children. And that brings me up to that phone call that I made to Dick P. Shortly after that phone call, I went into the living room to get comfortable in my chair. And it seems that I'd just been sitting there a minute or 2 minutes when that damn doorbell rang and there's two turkeys standing there at my door. I thought they were waiting for me next door, you know. Sure enough, they came in. I got to tell you about this because it was my first AA contact. And the one guy had a bow tie on. He had a crew cut haircut and a nice jacket. He looked good. And he looked like a college professor. And I hated college professors. The other guy had a Browns t-shirt on and he was a little, you know, he could have used a shave and he didn't say anything. And I kind of liked him a little bit. Bob took me in and he sat me down on my couch and he started to walk up and down in front of me talking. And he told me the most boring damn story about himself that I ever heard in my life. It was terrible. And I was yesing him and, oh yeah, sure, this and that. I agreed with everything he said. And finally he turned to me and he says, you know, he says, you haven't been being truthful with me. He says, you've been lying to me, you've been yesing me to death, and you've been agreeing with everything I say. And here's a guy that I just met, a lot smaller than myself, telling me that I'm a liar. Well, you know, I stood up and I was going to take him to the door, truthfully. And I had Bob by the arm and I looked up and here's Betty looking around the kitchen there, you know. And she was glaring at me and I said, so I let Bob go and I sat back down. And then he said, you know, he says, what I'm going to do with you, he says, I'm going to turn you over to Creed. I didn't even know the guy's name, but that was the other fellow. He said, maybe the two of you can help one another. And I didn't know what he was talking about. And Bob left. He just walked up. So Creed and I sat there and looked at each other for a few minutes. And I guess he didn't know what to say to me, and I sure as hell didn't know what to talk to him about. And you see, I didn't know it at that time, but Creed came into AA that morning. God bless him. He said to me, he said, well, he said, I'll tell you, Bob gave me a list of these meetings. We'll go, I'll come back tomorrow. And we'll start. I said, fine. I said, I never thought I'd see him again. But sure enough, he came back the next day, and Betty and Cree and I started to go to meetings. And we went, I guess Cree took us 15 or 18 consecutive meetings. And I'm sorry to say, Cree never did find sobriety. He was an in-and-outer. And just a few short years ago, he died an alcoholic's death, but for the grace of God. But Betty, by this time, she loved Alcoholics Anonymous. She just loved you people. Hell, I didn't want any part of it, you know. I was just there. I would sit in the back of the room. No reflection on you guys back there. But I was in the back of the room, and Betty just loved everything about it. You see, she was smart enough to know that there was a lot more to Alcoholics Anonymous than just sobriety. Feeling and ridicule a speaker, and nobody wanted to sit next to me. It got to the point where I was a loner in AA. I didn't want any part of it. I wouldn't pick up an ashtray. I wouldn't fold a chair. I just didn't want it. I was just there for her. Just to get her off my back. And as Betty mentioned last night, we went to meetings for a year and a half or better and didn't miss any. And I was the most uncomfortable son of a gun in the world because I hadn't participated, I was not involved, I was just sober, which was nothing. It was a little better than being drunk, but really I hadn't grown in any respect in my program. I didn't have a program. As I say, we went for well over a year and a half. And then someone mentioned to me that I should start do some things, like big chairman, like Pete. Pete's a big shot, he's a chairman. And I thought maybe this would be all right. It would be better than making that lousy coffee and doing these other dumb things. So I was chairman. And I'll have to admit, I got a kick out of it. I had six or seven sponsors at that time, and I invited them to speak. And I got kind of a charge out of it. And then shortly after that wonderful experience, one Saturday night, they nominated me for secretary. And I didn't want this job. It would tie me down every Saturday. And I, you know, there was things that I might be wanting to do rather than go to an AA meeting Saturday night. And I didn't want it, but I was too much of a coward to stand up and refuse it. But Frank nominated me, and then he sat down waiting for somebody to second it, and nobody evidently thought it was a good idea. So Frank stood back up and seconded his own. I was secretary of the Mentor Plains Group from that time on, and I really loved it. I really got to like it, and I enjoyed after meeting the people, and after that year, I hated to give it up. I truly did, because I gained such a great deal from that experience. Tell you about my first talk. I went over to the Lakewood Men's Group. They had 165 or 70 men that night, and I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, but I thought that I knew a hell of a lot about football. So I gave them one of the two-hour leagues of football. These guys tolerated me. My sponsors were sitting right down in front, and I felt pretty good. As I say, I didn't talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't mean to imply that I know that much more about it today, but it's a great deal more than I knew 16 years ago, I guarantee you. And I told them about some of the things that I had done as a player after the game and so forth, and I won't get into that, of course, today. If some of you want to hear that in stories, I'll be here for the rest of the weekend. But anyway, I sat down, and they had a comment period, and there was a fellow that stood up in the back of the room that I had never seen before, and he made a comment that went something like this. He said, "Brian," he says, "you know, I'm from Pittsburgh." And he says, "I used to see you play on Sunday." And here the ego just started to, I almost exploded. And I was thinking that he was going to tell this group what a great athlete and wonderful football player that I'd been. And then I can remember him saying in the next sentence, "Didn't they commonly refer to you as the tight end?" Well, I want to tell you, in 1942, we didn't have any tight ends in the National Football League. They had a left end and a right end and a flanker and a split end, and they hadn't started to refer to them as tight ends. Now, I've looked through those record books, and I've never been mentioned in any of the records, so I've taken it upon myself to have the distinct title of being the original tight end in the National Football League. But that night meant a great deal to me, and I didn't recognize it then, but I know, and I tell that story because I think it's funny. But more than that, it did a lot other things for me that I was unaware of at that time. After the meeting, I went back, and I was upset because nobody had ever laughed at me too much before. And here this guy was making cracks at my expense, and I didn't like it, and I told him so. And Dave was laughing, and Henry, and Fred, and Warren, and all of my friends were around me, and they had their arms up on my shoulders, and they were laughing. And I knew then that if, you know, I wasn't dumb enough to know that if you can't beat them, join them. So, hell, in spite of myself, I started to laugh a little bit. I remember that. And I forgot about the resentments toward Dave. And, you know, even that night I felt that maybe these guys were on the level. Maybe they liked me a little bit, or maybe even loved me a little bit. You know, that's possible, I thought. And I felt a little bit more as though I belonged to something for the first time in a long, long time. And I went home and I told Betty, and we talked about it for quite a while, and I started to feel,
for the first time, as I say, in my life, that I had found my place. And I started to get a little more active. I started to do things because I wanted to do them, not because somebody asked me or I had to. I started to get involved with Alcoholics Anonymous, and my whole outlook changed. My whole life changed. And from that time on, by this time, Betty was into Al-Anon, and God, we started to work our programs together. And it's been a steady, slow, but steady uphill climb, and it's been all great and beautiful. For a lot of years, I used to walk into those meetings, even after this experience. But I'd walk into the meetings, and it's easy to be a good AA at an AA meeting. What the hell? You know, how's things going? Great. Might have had the worst day of my life. And, oh, everything's fine. And I'd been doing this. And, you know, everything isn't all that great. I personally think that this is where we learn about the disease of alcoholism. This is where we try to get better. At least, it's where I try to get better. I personally think that you have to take AA home with you and practice the principles, the fundamentals in your home. This is where I'd done most of the damage in my drunken years, kicking the booze around. This is where I caused most of my problems, so this is where I have to start making most of the amends. So this is the way I started to work. I started to try to take AA into my home. Betty mentioned that our three children we still have with us, and they surely are a joy, they truly are. I've had many benefits bestowed upon me since I've been sober, and I, here again, I'm not patting myself on the back, but to show you what happens when you sober up, I was inaugurated into the Hall of Fame of Butler, Pennsylvania, something that I know without question would never have happened if I hadn't straightened out my life. And that was a tremendous experience, and I truly love it. I've been welcomed back to the National Football League as an alumni. Betty and I and the children on some of the occasions take an active part. Once a year at the convention, I play golf with all the Cleveland Browns, and we have a great fellowship going there. The fact that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've never made any bones about it. My anonymity means absolutely nothing. They all know that I'm a member. Without getting into detail, I might add that there are two former teammates whom I have talked Alcoholics Anonymous to over the years who are now currently sober and in AA. And I think that's just super. That makes it all worthwhile, believe me. I could talk all day on my kids. I'm running out of time. They're not kids, they're young ladies. And I could tell a story, as Betty told, about our oldest daughter, Sandy, who has just taken her bar examination. And I could mention great things that the other three have done individually that have made Betty and I most proud to have been able to raise them in the environment in which we have, in an AA and an Al-Anon home. I'll tell you about Debbie. Debbie is, I usually get their ages screwed up, 20. And Deb was always the backward gal. She was a little shy, to say the least, and she wouldn't mix very well. And we were concerned with her when she was a freshman in high school. And we had talked about it, but Betty says, oh, she'll come right out of that. She'll grow out of it. And one day Debbie come home and she says, Dad, she says, would you and Mom allow me to take baton twirling lessons? And I said, well, why not? Well, sure. So Betty went out and got the costumes and the batons and all that jazz. And we got her the best instructors that we could find around that area. Later on, she took from the best in the country. But Debbie started to win fifth place trophies and fourth place and third place trophies. Pretty soon, second place trophies. To make a long story short, she became the number one twirler in Ohio just in a few short years. In her senior year, Betty and the girls went to Seattle, Washington to participate in the national competition where Debbie placed fourth in the nation. And this experience completely changed her. It brought her
the beautiful things out in her, and she had found her place in the world, the rest of the same as the other kids have done in their own areas. So we were extremely proud of her, and still are, of course. One day she came home from high school, and she says, "Dad," she says, "you know, one of the greatest things in the world has happened to me." She says, "I have been nominated as one of the homecoming candidates for homecoming queen." I said, "Well, my Lord," I said, "that is fantastic." Demna made a big fuss, and we kissed, and I just told her how proud I was of her, and of course I said, "You know, there's 7 candidates," and I said, "there can only be one winner, and you know in your competition, Dad, you can't always be the number one." She says, "I know, Dad." She says, "but I'm happy." And I said, "well, boy," I said, "we'll be there, and we'll be rooting for you, hon." And I couldn't, I was on needles and pins, you know. And Friday night came along, and they had the convertibles all lined up, and I got into one of the convertibles, and Debbie's sitting up on the canvas top, and I couldn't take my eyes off her. I had never been so proud in my entire life. I think it was the greatest night in my life. I know it was. And I couldn't take my eyes off that beautiful gal, and we took 2 passes around the field, and we got off on the far end, and we were lined up, the father and their beautiful daughters, one behind the other. And Debbie, all the band was playing, there was a lot of noise, and she was tugging at my arm, and I had to lean down and look down at that beautiful face, and I said, "what is it, honey?" She says, "Dad, I want to tell you something." She said, "for the last couple of years, I sat up in those stands, and I had the greatest longing in my heart that someday I would be privileged to stand down here on the 50-yard line, taking my dad by the arm as a candidate for homecoming queen." And she says, "you know," she says, "all my dreams have come true." She says, "my life is complete." 17 years old, her life was complete. Well, needless to say, I couldn't handle that, and I started to cry, and I took Deb into my arms and kissed her, and these other fathers and daughters standing behind me, I don't know what the hell they thought, and I don't care. I guess they thought we'd already won it, you know. But we crossed the field then and lined up in a half a circle in front of the stand, and they announced over the PA system that the new 1979 homecoming queen was Debbie Brown. And I almost fainted. It was just a great night. And we celebrated. We went up to the Pizza Hut, had pizza. And the girls went along their way to their various parties. Betty and I went home, and we gave thanks to God for the opportunity to be members of Al-Anon and AA. And we know, as I know, that this night would absolutely been an impossibility if it had not been for our 2 respective programs. No way would that have ever happened. In the first place, I wouldn't be here today. If I would have continued to frequent the places that I used to frequent as a drunkard, somebody would have done me in a long time ago, a knife in my back or something. There's no question about it. I know that. And every morning that I'm privileged to wake up, I consider it a bonus day. A bonus day, and that's exactly what it is. As I say, I would never have made it this far or long. And I thank God for that day. And Betty and I gave thanks that night. And I thank you people and hundreds and thousands all over the world just like you for making it possible for Betty and I to rebuild a life that was completely almost lost into what we have going for us today. We have raised our children, our family, in the most respected home that I know of, the way of life of the 12 steps in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. What else could be more perfect than that? I want to thank each and every one of you. It's been hot, I've talked too long, but it's truly a privilege to be in your company, and I hope and pray to God that you hang in there one day at a time. Thank you, and God bless you.